Namaste and welcome to another edition of the Bharat Vartha Weekly. I'm Roshan Karyappa. We have with us Abhishek Paul and Nirav Kanodra to run you through the news and events of the week that was. There were some controversial statements by former Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey about India trying to stifle free speech and so on. There was high drama in Tamil Nadu with the cabinet minister being arrested. Sadly, the Manipur crisis continues and a cyclone has been rampaging Gujarat. And finally, in some positive news, Novak Djokovic has set a record for the most Grand Slams in tennis. All of this and more on this Bharat Vartha Weekly. There were some interesting articles in The Economist about India, a couple of articles in 1 week. One, you know, which was kind of weird. It had this image of President Biden, the US President Biden, petting a tiger, which was supposedly India. And the caption read that India is not a reliable ally or something to that effect. And then we had a very frank and, as usual, entertaining interview of Dr. Jaishankar as well, our external affairs minister. Abhishek, Nirav, did you guys catch the interview? Nirav, what do you think?
Yeah, so I think the interview is very interesting. Dr. Jaishankar is a very articulate person, defends India's interests quite well, and articulates where basically what the US and the UK are used to is kind of vassal states, and India is not willing to be one. We remain non-aligned because we were colonized for like a long time. You can say like just not just the British colonization, but all before that also like the Mughal rule, which was they say they saw themselves as foreigners. I think that was one thing which India doesn't choose to do. So I think that is one. He's clearly articulated the India-US relationship, India's relationship with Russia, how like in defense through four presidents in the US, and India has had two governments in the last 20 years. So very, very well articulated. Also, he mentioned that yeah, the questions to him should be more about like foreign policy rather than like say domestic things, which he also did mention about India's whole digital backbone and the welfare which is being given out and bank accounts for all. So I think he looks at it like in a very, so he's a very good spokesperson for India and Indian policy. He does it very well. I think The Economist covers, we've said a lot of things. This time they've riffed on a picture from basically a Tiger King, which was a show on Netflix about a guy called Joe Exotic, who had this tiger zoo, tiger farm, and in Florida. So kind of like saying that, okay, Indian, the West can't rely on India. But I think India needs to look at its own interests. So we are not going to align with their interests where we have shared interests. Some of our interests could be opposite. Clear in case, India can also say the reverse, that the US has not been a reliable ally because they give a lot of aid to Pakistan, who has hosted a lot of terrorist groups. Whether the government is directly involved or not, that's debatable. But like they have given residence or they've harbored terrorists who are acting against India. So I think both sides, we have a lot of common interests. Some places we differ on, and India should focus on what is best for India and Indians. So I think that's there. One thing in the pipeline is Prime Minister Modi is going to the US. There are a lot of things going to come up now. You had Rahul Gandhi earlier made the trip to the US, etc. But like Prime Minister Modi is gone there. There's an agenda. I think there is a very key one. One is to make fighter jets and jet engines in India in a JV with Hindustan Aeronautics and American defense contractors. There is another one which is meeting a lot of tech, like the hardware CEOs, Dell, HP, etc. And a lot more assembly work for laptops, PCs, etc. also might happen in India. Again, there are critics who might say that, oh, this is just pure assembly work. But it creates jobs and gets India within the ecosystem. Also, it reduces our imports because we consume a lot of these things. So obviously, so that's also there. So there'll be a lot more headlines coming out next week, and we can talk about them next week.
Yeah, I think the US is still getting used to this era beyond, you know, you're with us or against us kind of a rhetoric, right? And Dr. Jaishankar has made it very clear on that interview as well, where we stand. And he has also said that, you know, the US-India relationship has been really transformed over the last three decades, especially post-65, I mean, how it was versus now, right? Yeah, Abhishek, what do you think about the Tiger King cover?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of expected from the Western media that they will try to sort of disparage India in subtle ways. But I didn't think it was too bad given you know, we have kind of graduated from cows and elephants to tiger now, I guess. But
Yeah, snake charmers.
yeah, snake charmers. So, I mean, coming to the Economist interview or the piece or you know, this current issue, which focuses a lot on India, is a part of a broader series of articles and publications coming out in what, let's say, prestige Western media, right? So, one of the interesting ones a few days or weeks before was in the Foreign Affairs magazine by the Indian origin, but currently the US citizen analyst Ashley Tellis, right? Headline was very provocative, saying, calling it in America's bad bet on India, right? But a few days back, he actually appeared on the print channel, right, where he gave an interview explaining his article, and basically he was saying that maybe the headline did not really capture what he was trying to say. And he's trying to say that Americans need to temper their expectations about what India can and cannot do. Economist piece also kind of talks about it. There are others also talking about it. Is that if there are Americans who expect India to militarily help them in a conflict over Taiwan, then they are wrong. India will not step in to sort of operationally help out the US and the Western forces if there is a conflict over Taiwan. But other than that, and similarly, I mean, we've not, you know, done that in Iraq, right? There was an opportunity for India to join the war on terror and, you know, send troops to Iraq, but we chose not to do that 22 years ago. So essentially, India will not be a proper military ally. What, you know, Nirav talked about vassal state, right? That is their sort of default expectation when they make friends and allies in other parts of the world. But other than that, there are many areas of cooperation that India and US can enter into. India can be a lucrative market for American weapons, right? Which ultimately is also a big area of interest for American politicians, right? Because they have to keep feeding their military industrial complex. Basically, it's a bit of expectation management, which is kind of happening in the Western media, that look, these guys are not really good guys, but we need them right now to counterbalance China, and we need them for our as markets. So, you know, we have to get along with this not so nice person. I think that's the sort of undertone that I get from all of these articles or, you know, commentary in general.
All right. Moving on, in a recent exclusive interview with Breaking Point, founder and ex-CEO of Twitter, Jack Dorsey, made sensational claims about Twitter's treatment in India. He claimed that the Indian government had threatened to shut down Twitter if it didn't take action against, to quote, certain journalists and accounts that were critical of the government. He made these claims while talking about Twitter's crusade for free speech and how it was impacted by takedown requests by different countries. However, Jack very conveniently left out the part where the company primarily catered to takedown and shadow ban requests from the radical left wing in the US. Which perhaps, I mean, he kind of agrees with, right? Well, you know, we've often brought up this point, you know, many different times on the podcast that, you know, Twitter tends to think of itself as some kind of a supranational entity, right? That they're above the law, that they're a sovereign in itself. But I mean, it's high time that that thinking changes, right? And I think it is changing, right? Because one of the first things that Elon mentioned as he took over Twitter was also that, hey, we will comply with laws and regulations in whatever countries, right? And you've seen that with Turkey, for example, right? I mean, he's working with the government there on you know, taking down certain certain accounts and certain kind of information and so on. Now, these allegations that Jack made have been properly refuted by Rajiv Chandrasekhar, the minister, right? He calls them outright lies, and he's basically said that between 20 and 22, there were bunch of violations that Twitter made, whether it is you know, in violation of Article 14 or Article 19 on right to equality and basically free speech. But, you know, Twitter was allowed to function, right? And only in June of 2022 is when, you know, they started complying with some of these things, right? The argument against India, what I have read in some places, is that we have the most number of claims that we have filed, right? In terms of, you know, takedown requests and whatnot. But again, you know, this is a classic sort of a mistake in going with the total numbers and not taking percentages. Despite all of this, I think, you know, this routine of Jack to surface once in a while and, you know, appear like this boy genius, you know, slash hippie who cares about the world and who's sort of a champion of the global liberal order. And, you know, he righteously tried to protect freedoms and whatnot, right? Despite all of this, I mean, it doesn't hold water, you know, because you saw what Twitter has done, or even the other platforms, whether it's Meta or Google or whatever, have done multiple times in the US, right? Or Europe as well. I mean, we all have, you know, clips of the congressional hearings and whatnot, right? Where, I mean, these guys have complied. And Twitter itself has no standing in this, right? I mean, we've seen Twitter files, for instance, where they suppressed news about the Hunter Biden laptop and whatnot. So, yeah, I think it's a bit rich for Jack to talk about these things. And yeah, I think it was handled very well by the minister, Rajiv Chandrasekhar. All right. In some local politics, high drama unfolded in Tamil Nadu this week as the state's cabinet minister, Senthil Balaji, was arrested in a money laundering probe by the Enforcement Directorate. Soon after his arrest, the minister was admitted to Omandarur Hospital as he complained of chest pain and being ill-treated by the Enforcement Directorate, and he also underwent a coronary angiogram. On Friday, a Chennai session court denied Senthil Balaji's bail plea and granted the ED an 8-day custody. Abhishek, can you tell us what's happening here?
So, the minister in question, Senthil Balaji, used to be a minister in the AIADMK government in the past. And whatever allegations the ED has right now of this so-called, I would say it's called like a cash for jobs kind of scam, it relates to the period in which he was in AIADMK as the transport minister. The current CM of Tamil Nadu, M.K. Stalin, also had alleged corruption allegations against him when he was in the opposition in 2016, right? But in 2018, he switched parties and he won as an MLA in 2019 and became a minister in the current DMK government. So that's the background. So basically, I think more than the particular details of the case, and of course there is local politics ongoing in Tamil Nadu with, you know, the BJP pushing very hard various allegations of corruption, including through the DMK files and all that, right? Which Annamalai has been leading the charge on social media. But beyond that, I think why this has kind of become a bigger national issue is this has become, and this has kind of united a lot of opposition parties, is now that there is a perception building that the BJP government at the center has been using, you know, various investigative bodies like the CBI, ED, etc., of targeting opposition politicians in various states in which the opposition parties are ruling. And so this is where this kind of gave an opportunity to, you know, all opposition parties, whether it is the Congress, the AAP, or even parties from Jammu and Kashmir who have basically no interest in Tamil Nadu politics, to chime in and sort of further the narrative that the BJP is kind of unfairly using these investigative bodies to target opposition politicians. So for now, he will be, you know, under the custody of ED till, I think, the 28th of June. We'll have to see, you know, how the investigation plays out. One other thing that has happened is that the DMK government would like to take away the portfolio of ministries that he was holding, but keep him as a minister, like a minister without portfolio, while the governor has sort of chimed in that you cannot be a minister without portfolio, and he needs to resign. So that's another sort of debating point right now and currently in this case.
Right. Yeah, I think Tamil Nadu politics seems to have suddenly become very exciting and seems to have really shook up after, you know, Annamalai's entry into politics, right? So perhaps, I mean, we should do an episode on Tamil Nadu politics, maybe with Prasanna of Swarajya. We have thought about it earlier, but, you know, let us know if, you know, who else we should host on Tamil Nadu politics specifically. All right, moving on. Over the past couple of days, Cyclone Biparjoy has wreaked havoc on the state of Gujarat. Several electricity grids and highways have been rendered useless due to strong winds and heavy rainfall. Trees have been uprooted and houses damaged. A few lives have been lost and thousands injured. Lakhs of people have been relocated to temporary homes away from the coastal regions. The NDRF and the state's relief unit have deployed hundreds of teams to assist in restoring movement and electricity as soon as possible. Nirav, I know you have some family in Gujarat. I mean, I hope they're all safe. Is this under control now? I mean, what's happening?
So, no, absolutely. As in, see, India has learned a lot from the previous cyclones. Cyclones are more predominant on the Indian East Coast, Odisha being frequently hit with cyclones. But I think the institutional knowledge, one is the IMD, Indian Meteorological Department, did a very good job on forecasting the timing. And we took a lot of preemptive action. I think 65,000 to 1 lakh people were moved away from the coastal areas, especially in regions of Kutch and like Saurashtra. Right now, I think only 2 lives have been lost, maybe a few thousand injured. There are some people probably who didn't obey, or like, it's really unfortunate. 2 is also too many, but in previous years in such cyclones, you would have seen a lot more devastation. So it's good coordination between, you would say, local governments. So like the Gram Panchayats plus the city municipal corporations plus the state government plus the central government. We had a lot of learning from such things in Odisha and Andhra. Coastal Andhra, and so here in Gujarat, we've been preemptive. And now, like, one of the things which is a lot of trees have been uprooted in the Gir forest sanctuary, where we have a few lions in the wild. So I think there is some sort of like wildlife and rehabilitation work going on there as well to ensure that there's not a lot of loss of wildlife as well. So I think that is there. This just goes to show the gradual rise in institutional capabilities, as in these events keep happening. The thing is, can we be prepared? Can our society and the country be prepared for such things? And how can we manage the damage? I think Gujarat has come a long way since there was an earthquake in Kutch in the year 2001. And that was very devastating, right? And so since then, institutional capability, not just in the state, but also in the country, has increased. And it's a positive sign. So I think now it's gone past Gujarat and Kutch. And now it's hitting Pakistan. They had a very bad flood in the Sindh region as well last year. So I don't know about them. Hopefully, any country, like, hopefully the loss of life and loss of property, etc., is a bare minimum. But it tells you that we can't control the nature, but can we be better prepared? Can we be better coordinated? And that's how we need to learn to live with these things. So, yeah, that's a very heartening sign.
Well, from a crisis in the West, we move on to a crisis in the East. Ethnic unrest continues in Manipur with 9 people killed and 25 others injured in fresh violence in the region. The militants, armed with automatic weapons, opened fire on sleeping people and also hurled bombs in Kamenlok village at the border of Imphal. A press conference was held by representatives of the Methi community who demanded the center's intervention in restoring peace in the state. This crisis seems to be worsening and, you know, people have been criticizing the Home Minister of inaction. But, you know, what is the government doing to kind of arrest this?
Yeah, I mean, the situation continues to remain very bad in Manipur. And the trip of the Home Minister there, I think a couple of weeks back, hasn't really brought down the level of violence significantly. I mean, we continue to see these kind of killings still ongoing. One of the initiatives that was taken post that trip was forming a peace committee, right, which would involve members of civil society, government, etc., and, you know, people from both sides of the conflict. But unfortunately, the Kuki members in that committee refused to join because they said that, you know, there are members of the government or there are members of the opposition, opposite side with whom they cannot, you know, sit on the table. Then there were others who said that, you know, they had been added to the peace committee without their consent itself. So that initiative has kind of totally stalled. And then, of course, we continue to see violence. And, you know, there have been attacks, not only the ones that you mentioned, but even politicians are now, and their houses are now being targeted. The house of various MLAs or even the, I think the Minister of State for External Affairs, Rajkumar Ranjan Singh, his residence was set on fire yesterday. So I think, yeah, it's pretty bad. And the only hope people seem to, or, you know, any sort of confidence people seem to have is in the armed forces, right? That they are probably the only people with whom who can sort of try to bring down or stop this violence. But politically, the situation seems very grim.
Yeah, let's hope the situation is resolved at the earliest. Thoughts and prayers with everyone who's been affected. Moving on, to end things on a positive, more optimistic note, Novak Djokovic set a new record this week as he won his 23rd career Grand Slam title, surpassing Rafael Nadal's 22. He's now the first man in tennis history with a triple career slam. That means winning all four Grand Slam events. I think that was called a Golden Slam. Not sure. In 2016, 21 and 23. He's also the oldest player to win Roland Garros in the tournament's history. Well, I think Abhishek is the Novak fan among all three of us. The biggest Novak fan, at least. Right, Abhishek? What do you think?
Yeah, I think this is like a tremendous achievement. And it's like the same thing with, you know, Messi, right? Like, there will still be people who will be debating his GOAT status and all that. And I see, you know, people, Federer and Nadal fans, still refusing to, you know, laying claim on that moniker. But to me, there, I think there are no more arguments to be made. He's played more time facing the prime of Federer and Nadal than the opposite case, right? Because a lot of early part of Federer's career was when he didn't face Djokovic, because Djokovic wasn't yet on the scene. And then obviously first few years of his career as well. So Djokovic only faced Nadal and Federer in their prime. And then probably towards the back end, a few years where, you know, at least in the case of Federer, he was kind of well past his prime. So in my view, among the three of them, Djokovic faced the maximum amount of competition quality. And then I would say he's faced a massive amount of bad press coverage from tennis media, Western liberal media, and so on, right? I mean, some of the articles that came out in the Guardian newspaper last week were like astonishing, right? One of them begins with like, if a 10 feet tall player, you know, one wins 30 Grand Slam, you won't call him the GOAT. And so the analogy here is that since Djokovic's fitness is superior, you know, that kind of brings down the quality of his achievements. I mean, then there were people, I mean, Djokovic has kind of taken stands which are contrary to the Western establishment's narrative on various issues. For example, we all know he refused to take the COVID vaccine. But what kind of shocked the Western media was that he was willing to give up chance to win Grand Slam tournaments for the sake of his beliefs. And he stood by his beliefs, you know, despite this massive criticism. So that was one. He recently in Paris, a couple of weeks back, talked about, you know, violence that is happening back in Kosovo, right? Which again, the Guardian newspaper called his call to peace as, you know, Djokovic is talking about erasing Kosovo from the map, right? This is the kind of way in which his political statements are, I mean, his statements are politicized and, you know, given a spin by the media. So basically, look, he's faced tremendous challenges in terms of out of the court sort of places, right? I mean, I saw the opposite hyperbole as well, where, you know, he was compared to Muhammad Ali and all that by his supporters, but I wouldn't go that far. But I feel like his accomplishments on the court are tremendous, and he's still some way to go before, you know, he retires, right? So we don't know where he will stop. If he stops today, I would still say he's the best tennis player of all time, but maybe, you know, if he wins four more Grand Slams, then that'll probably be good enough for a few more people. But then he'll never be the darling of the press like, you know, Federer or Nadal have been over the years.
No, I think, see, you can have your favorites with respect to sport, right? I mean, because every person is different. But, you know, when you're talking about the best, right? I mean, you're talking about some objective measure here, right? And you can slice and dice the data and analyze things differently. But nothing beats consistency, right? And whether it is Sachin Tendulkar or Michael Jordan or maybe Michael Phelps in swimming, etc., I mean, these folks are objectively the best for a certain reason, whether it's the 100 centuries of Tendulkar, whether it's the 5 world titles of Jordan and, you know, the many, many baskets and points he got, or whether it's the, I don't know, 15, 19, how many ever Olympic medals that Phelps won, right? I mean, these are objective standards. And similarly, you know, 23 Grand Slams is a phenomenal achievement. I mean, you know, we saw an era of tennis where people retired at, you know, 29, 30. Sampras himself retired at 32, right? And then these folks are playing, you know, well past that age, right? And I think they may end up playing at 40 even, right? I mean, Novak looks in very good form right now. So to say that, you know, he won all of these slams because he's fitter, he's taller, and he's, you know, physically better. Well, I mean, sport is a measure of physical performance also, right? So why not? I mean, if that's an advantage, then so be it, right? But I think these are endless debates, you know. I mean, people used to compare Sampras and Federer, and Federer himself was given that bit of a thing saying that, you know, you know, he's getting all these Grand Slams, but, you know, Sampras had that beautiful serve and volley game, and, you know, he played in a different era and all of those things. So this is like an endless debate that continues, I think, every, you know, 5 or 10 years, every era of tennis. But yeah, I mean, I think we're all supremely privileged to have watched the best era of tennis, right? So far, objectively, I think Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, Nirov.
Yeah, so just to add, right, I think what Djokovic has done, so you can say that, oh, he's fit, but what has he done for his fitness? You see, like, a lot of his interviews about his diet, how he took out almost all meat apart from like raw fish, and he removed gluten from his diet. So he's taken very tough decisions. His training regimen, right? So he is very fit, but why is he so fit? Then lastly, I want to say that Federer, he said that he had no shot at like winning the French Open, so he would skip the whole clay season in Europe and just focus on grass and then go straight to the Wimbledon, right? So after the Australian Open, he wouldn't play like a lot of tournaments. You look at Nadal, his game was a lot more suited to clay. So at clay, he peaked at the French Open. And then usually, whatever, he had some knee issues, knee injury issues, etc. Either in Wimbledon, he would bow out early. And then a lot of times he missed the US Open due to injury as per the calendar. So what Djokovic has is like consistency across surfaces. So he's got like 10 Australian Opens, 3 French Opens, 7 Wimbledons, and like 3 US Opens, right? So fairly evenly spread out. He's done very well on because you had a champion on grass and a champion on clay, so his hardcore record looks the best. But I would say like he's equally good. It's just that those two chose one surface to like really specialize on. So maybe Djokovic won more hardcore tournaments. But this just goes to show. And second is, we are living in an era across sports where a lot better diet, a lot better fitness, and having fitness coaches, not overworking and avoiding burnout, and a lot more sports science has come in. So you see longevity for a lot of athletes. And it is also a function of this timing, this era, rather than like other athletes did not have these same things. I would say even like 15 years ago. That is there, but it's great. And as you said, we are privileged to watch this great rivalry. And I would say like Djokovic, where he nudges ahead, I would say his fitness and his versatility, right? Federer might have a very good single-handed backhand, or Nadal might have a better clay game. But if you look at an all-round player, I think yes, Djokovic really deserves to be called the GOAT. And we wait and watch till someone else better comes ahead and surpasses him, right? Maybe, who knows?
Yeah. No, you bring up a very important point, right? Which is that longevity in sports has gone up. Thanks to all of this scientific, coaching, performance, all of that stuff. Tom Brady, who plays in the NFL, is 46 years old, right? And NFL is like a brutal sport. So, yeah, I mean, there's certainly exciting times ahead in sports for sure. All right, on that note, we've come to the end of the Bharat Vartha Weekly. If you stayed with us this long, thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you liked the content. If you did, don't forget to rate and review us on your favorite platform. It'll help more people discover our content. Next week, we have an interesting episode with Shivkumar Ji, who is an author and curator. We're going to talk about his new book, Arya, an anthology of Vedic women. This will be hosted by my friend Sharanya. So interesting conversation lined up for next week. Do let us know if there are specific topics or, guests that we should host and cover. We're always listening on our social platforms. We're at Bharat Vartha on Twitter, Facebook, and elsewhere. All right. So from Abhishek, Nirav, and myself, thank you for joining. And see you soon next week. Take care. Jai Hind.